And John Gibler, our special correspondent, was at the funeral. He joins us now from Mexico City. John, welcome back to Flashpoints. Tell us something about this young man and what happened at the funeral today.
Today we're at the wake still. They're going to be present with Alexis here at the wake all evening and throughout the night, and then he'll be buried tomorrow. There are about 100 or so people outside the wake area right now. Many people from Atenco, from the university, Alexis' classmates and friends, people from several of the major unions and participants in other campaign, a lot of people who didn't know Alexis as well, coming to show their support and solidarity. The Zapatista Army of National Liberation sent a very large collection of flowers with a banner there saying that his passing was not in vain, was in the context of a struggle which the people here will be continuing.
John, where are you now? Where is the wake being held?
It's in Mexico City, an area of the city known as Colonia Roma.
And say something about what happened so that people who perhaps missed the initial story understand a little bit more about how we got to this place where you are now sitting there at the wake.
Of course. On May 4th, the very first few minutes of the police raid on Atenco, people were out in the street. Several people, protesters, were still intending to impede access of the police into the town, but it was immediately apparent that the overwhelming numbers of the riot police coming in were going to lift their blockade, and they withdrew within these first few minutes.
Why were they blockading?
The blockade was originally built on or put up on the highway outside of Atenco in solidarity with flower sellers who had been arrested and beaten the day before in Texcoco. So the blockade is a solidarity gesture for the people in Texcoco and a demand that those political prisoners be released from the day before. And it's very important to kind of have the context that those people were told, the flower sellers in Texcoco were told by the state government that they would be able to sell that day, but then it was a setup as they were met with hundreds of riot police and were beaten when they tried to gain access to their local market. So that morning they were still trying to hold the blockade in solidarity with Texcoco. When the police arrived in overwhelming numbers, over 3,000 riot police surrounded the town. A small group of union workers and university students sent out a commission of about 5 people to see if they could dialogue, which is a very standard practice in a lot of these confrontations on highway blockades, to seek a dialogue first. But within those first few moments, the first line of police fired tear gas rifles into the crowd and at this small commission coming out to look for a dialogue. Alexis Benumea, 20-year-old economy student, was in that commission, and he was shot close range in the head with the tear gas pellet, which is about 3 inches long and an inch in diameter. This immediately broke open his skull, and his father and 2 friends carried him inside of a house where they sought refuge. There was a doctor in the house who was able to bandage the wound. His brain was exposed. But due to the police siege of the town and the surrounding barricade of police officers, they were unable to gain access to an ambulance. They called the Red Cross. The Red Cross sent an ambulance, but the federal police did not let it pass through. And as a result, Alexis sat or laid unconscious, bleeding into his bandages for over 11 hours. Finally, as I was actually going into town to report around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I received a cell phone call informing me that there was a wounded person in the house and could I help get them out into a hospital. It took about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours, for me to get a combi and get access into the house, get Alexis out into a hospital. He went into 4 hours of brain surgery, survived, but quickly went into a coma. His brain failed about 10 days later, she was in a deep coma. And then just last night at 2 in the morning, he passed away.
Okay, you're listening to Friday Morning After. It is 8:28. I'm pleased to be joined on the phone with Michael Werbowski. Good morning, Michael.
Yes, good morning, Joe.
How are you?
The same time zone.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. You were down in Mexico for a very long time. Can you tell us, when did you get back?
I got back actually at the end of the last month, and sort of to follow up on your last on-air broadcast about Atenco. Just when I arrived, and I think when we spoke last, it was just before the confrontation at Atenco, and of course events certainly spun out of control. The confrontation between the police and the protesters, as we heard in the last on-air broadcast, turned very ugly. And what I wanted to give sort of the listeners too is the overview of the pre-electoral campaign atmosphere in the country. It certainly suddenly this Atenco affair took over the airwaves, and there was a total shift of atmosphere in Mexico. I was shocked to go to several newsstands, and every day we read accounts in papers such as La Jornada about the violations against women that took place, the police beatings, dreadful human rights abuses, and it all sort of added a real, it tainted the 6-year tenure of President Fox. Here was the president about to, you know, go out with a certain amount of prestige after 6 years of keeping the country more or less in a positive light internationally. Then you had this dreadful Atenco affair, and everything sort of shifted at that stage.
Well, it's quite impressive. On narconews.com, there's actually a link that you can go to now and see the video of the police storming San Salvador Atenco and Texcoco. When you see the coverage, when you were down there, the media coverage, was it? What was your impression of the media coverage as they showed did they show the video down there?
The media, the television, of course, media showed different snippets of this, but the photos of the actual arrests and the accounts were extraordinary. I mean, you had just a case of an Argentinian student studying in Mexico City, a film student who went to Atenco. Maybe your listeners were aware of this, but she was just happened to be there with her video cam. She was immediately arrested and thrown into the paddy wagon, and then there was a whole daily account in La Jornada. It was a bit like reading a sordid pornographic novel, where she tells how she was molested, how she was repeatedly raped without penetration, whatever that would mean. And there was constant sordid accounts from her and colleagues from other universities, foreign observers, other women who came to Mexico with NGOs were also raped and molested on the paddy wagon, on the ride to the airport in the paddy wagon, and then they were deported. And so you had, like, within 48 hours, you had these accounts coming out in the press, mostly in the print press, about these incidents from these women who had been deported either to Argentina or either to Spain. And then immediately when these things came out, you had protests mobilized in Spain, in the United States, in Argentina, in front of Mexican consulates. So each day, more and more unseemly details came out about what happened, how the police brutalized and violated women. And of course, we had this death, this tragic death of one of the protesters. So it certainly gave Mexico a really bad press internationally.
And there are currently, I believe, 31 people still held down in Mexico for over the protests. Do you have any idea of what the conditions are they're being held in? Because I read online, and I'm not sure about this, so I wanted to get your opinion on this, because people were comparing this to early 70s style Mexico brutalization of protesters, and so I want to get your opinion on whether you feel like are people going to see their day in court? Is this coming soon, or are they being held sort of like under a security certificate kind of treatment, where they don't even know what the charges are against them?
Well, luckily I wasn't. I hadn't been in the midst of all this, and I quite frankly can only imagine how horrendous the conditions are. But it would probably, to draw a comparison to the situation they're in, is we had this in Monterrey, protests last year, I believe, where you had a Quebecois who was there, who inadvertently was arrested, and they pummeled them, they put them into jail cells, and these people are held, of course, without charges for unlimited amount of time. I'm not a legal expert, but I can imagine that they will probably be there at least until after the July 2nd elections, because the government, of course, has politicized this issue, and the opposition candidates have politicized this issue, so they would probably keep them there in a holding pattern, if you will, for at least this month, so that if they would be released, they would probably denounce further the actions of the government, rightly so, but this would obviously compromise the lead of Felipe Calderon, who's seems to be gaining in the polls. And Felipe Calderon is with the ruling PAN party, who have received President Fox's endorsement. And so while all of this, while all these grisly and grim details came out about the abuses, the brutality, the imprisonment of the protesters, you had President Fox coming out and declaring that rule of law must be, hold supreme. He also came out in favor of Felipe Calderon, the PAN candidate. He was subsequently castigated by the IFED, Instituto Federal Electoral, for actually promoting his man or his candidate, which is, of course, would be his successor, the PAN candidate Felipe Calderon. The government officials, of course, justified these actions. And then you had, on the other side, you had the subcomandante Marcos with his La Otra Compañía, his other campaign, who immediately went on the site. And if I'm not mistaken, his efforts are there to pressure authorities to release these detainees, as they call them, or political prisoners, as some others would say. But eventually, I doubt very much that they would be released before the end of the elections or the votes, July 2nd, and I would imagine that their conditions that they're being held under are quite horrendous.
And I believe I read that there are 31 people being held, and that they are currently on a hunger strike.
That was the last I heard of that, was that they've engaged in a hunger strike. So the situation there is, of course, very, very explosive. And I'm sure your listeners have, or CKUT listeners know, that Atenco, Texcoco, was the scene of confrontations between the FARC government in 2001 when he proposed to build the airport, second airport terminal out there, and of course land would have to be confiscated, and the farmers and residents of Texcoco and Atenco resisted this plan. So the press reports are basically that the government is taking its revenge now against the local Atenco residents for what happened in 2001. And this certainly has backfired. I mean, it has really compromised the Fox administration.
You spoke about Monsieur Calderon. As we know that, as you stated before, there are elections coming up on July 2nd. How has the issue of Atenco, San Salvador Atenco, and Texcoco, how have the candidates approached that issue? Have they approached that issue? And is it a major issue as far as, you know, as the elections move forward?
Well, in a nutshell, after the events, the main beneficiary of these of this tragic occurrence was Subcomandante Marcos, who seized on the moment, and his campaign was energized. He's not officially running for president, but he's a kind of a media sensation in the sense that he's going around supporting the Atenco struggle. And this certainly energized his flagging support. The Felipe Calderon and Lopez Obrador, the two front runners, they were somewhat critical. Of course, Obrador was using this as a campaign slug, or there was a slugging match between Calderon and Obrador over the excessive use of government police authority forces. The third candidate, Roberto Madrazo of the PRI, he was the most outspoken on this, but he has the least chance of coming anywhere near victory in the polls. But the main slugging match was not over Atenco. That seemed to be something that Subcomandante Marcos seized upon. The two leading candidates, Lopez Obrador and Felipe Calderon, are using really the most the lowest kind of denunciations, the lowest kinds of vilifications against each other. Felipe Calderon is comparing Lopez Obrador to a Chavez-like populist, a fanatic who will bring Mexico back into the dark ages of state control of the economy. Lopez Obrador is charging Felipe Calderon as being a thief who had his hands in the cooking jar during the huge fallout from the FOBA PROA bank bailout, which was something that occurred after 1994. You had the banks receiving billions of dollars from the Mexican state to bail them out, and Felipe Calderon signed on to this political program. So basically, Lopez Obrador is saying that if you want this man to be your president, you know that if there'll be another economic crisis, he'll bail out the banks, and you, the middle class, will suffer for it. So there are scare tactics used on both sides. Atenco was certainly a prominent issue in the media, but the two major candidates seem to sidestep it in a way because it was a very explosive issue.
I have seen in the press that people are saying that the Bush administration is trying to support Monsieur Calderon, and they don't want to see another leftist candidate elected in South America. It's not South America, but you know, in this area, because we saw elections in Peru and Bolivia, and obviously in Venezuela, where the people seem to be moving more to the left. Although in Colombia, they did reelect President Uribe. Do you see, when you were down there, did you see any kind of major media pushed for Calderon?
Well, the media is controlled by a monopoly called Televisa, which is the largest media chain there, the television conglomerate, and they're certainly backing Felipe Calderon 100%, and they have spots, as they call, as one would say, or publicity, publicity advertising Felipe Calderon on every one of their shows. So he has a tremendous the backing of this huge media conglomerate, which brings us to the issue of the concentration of the media in Mexico, which is another phenomenon that I would like to raise with you another time. But so he has this tremendous backing. He also has the backing of President Fox and the Friends of Fox, which are entrepreneurs, industrialists, financiers. So he certainly has got no problems with backing from a tremendous amount of very influential and powerful people. As far as the connection with President Bush, if there might certainly be one, but the U.S. government, of course, is doing its utmost, its very best, to stay out of this campaign, to show that the choice has to be made by the Mexican people. There's one issue, of course, which is where the U.S. government cannot completely remain at bay, if you will, or aloof to. It's the shutting down physically of the Mexican U.S. border. And when I was there, that was the other major problem, was how to increase security, as the Americans would like to see it, on their side of the border, without strangling Mexico, and that means without strangling their economy, which is so reliant on the Mexican migrants who send remittance payments back to Mexico, and these are billions of dollars, Joe. So this was another big issue in the media, and the media, whether it was on the left or on the right, all denounced the new security border measures that President Bush announced in the beginning of May. And immigration reform, of course, followed up on that. These came up during the election campaign, and President Fox, who went over to the U.S. to plead for immigration reform, for a kind of a settlement of the undocumented workers in the U.S., undocumented Mexican workers, and all other major party candidates did the same.
What are the candidates' positions as far as immigration goes down there, Calderon and Obrador? Go ahead.
Yeah, like I said, the two front runners would like to see the whole enchilada that was what Fox proposed. The whole enchilada being a global migratory accord between the U.S. and Mexico take place. It didn't happen under Fox. And many people don't think it'll happen under a new Mexican president, but they are concerned about the possibility of a militarization of the Mexican U.S. border, and the shutting down, if you will, of the constant flux of a migratory flow between the two countries. Calderon raised the issue when he was on his campaign whistle stop tours of Mexico. Basically, they all agree that the United States shouldn't be shutting down the border. The problem is that on the Mexican side of the border, the army is not there's no army presence to at least assist these migrants as they get to the border. It's basically a no man's land until you get to the U.S. border. So if you want to head north, you can just go through the northern part of Mexico up to the border, and if you make it to the other side, well, good luck to you. But there is no police presence or army presence to regulate this flux as these people head north.
Well, it's very scary because the United States has already mandated 6,000 National Guard to be on the border, and we all know that a certain amount of migrants die each year. Is there a conversation going on down there about how that National Guard is going to affect I don't know what to say. You know, go ahead.
Of course. I mean the whole idea of these, you know, Mexicans who see the American dream from their small villages and towns as being so attractive, dying in the desert is something that the media and colleagues I spoke to have emphasized. But, you know, I remember going when I first went there in 2000 and 2001, and I was collaborating with a prominent newspaper called The Excelsior, and we covered a lot of these issues, and they got a lot of they got front page coverage in the Mexican press. But it's only been recently, now that you see coming back here to Canada, that I see news reports in the U.S. media about these deaths, about these people who risk their lives just to find work. If I could just say in parentheses, this whole problem of migration, I think, is basically is an indictment of the failure of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which promised jobs, prosperity for Mexican workers. There's none of that. You since it's been signed in 1994, which of course coincidentally was also when the Zapatista movement became active. President Salinas was in power. Well, you haven't seen that the NAFTA delivered to the Mexican people. It's delivered to the major multinationals, American multinationals. It has given them a tremendous access to the Mexican market. If you go to Mexico now, you would really think that you're in the United States, or just with a few cactuses. You've got box stores, you've got the Walmart, you've got the Super Sam's, you've got everything there. But these franchises are there. They have brought certain amount of prosperity, but they have not delivered. In other words, they haven't created enough jobs in Mexico, and that's why these workers, migrants, are coming to the United States. So in that sense, NAFTA didn't do what it was supposed to do for Mexico.
Well, and I read a report yesterday, and it said that 1 in 34 people are migratory in the world, and so this isn't 1 in 34 is actually a big number when we're talking about people migrating around the world and trying to find work and trying to find a better life. Are there any other issues that you'd like to speak about before we go? Because we're going to have to go soon.
Okay, I just wanted to raise that Mexico is now in a pre-electoral mode, as I said, but there is the potential of another major economic devaluation, or what we saw in 1994, an economic collapse. The Mexican peso is very overvalued. The U.S. dollar is undervalued, and the Mexican peso is pegged to the dollar. So as the dollar goes down, the Mexican peso is going down with it. And many, many economists and academics, some who I've spoken to, fear that we may see before or after the presidential election a huge drop in the peso, which would be a devastating blow to the middle class. The middle class in Mexico now is really between a rock and a hard place. The concentration of wealth since I've been there last time has increased to the elite top 1 or 2%, while poverty has increased and the middle class is shrinking. So economists and Mexico observers of you are watching to see, will we have another devaluation like the one in 1994, and many observers think that Mexico is ripe for an evaluation, a revaluation of the peso, which would mean a devaluation in the coming months. So many of the candidates, although they don't want to panic the population, they are aware of this possibility. So whoever gets in may be dealing with a major economic crisis in the future.
Okay. We've been speaking with Michael Werbowski, and he is a continual contributor to CKUT Friday Morning After. You can also read his stories on worldpress.org. And I thank you for joining me this morning. And
indeed. Muchas gracias a usted.
Welcome back to Canada. And
it's nice to be back in Canada, where the only things, the only beings that are massacred and slaughtered are those baby pup seals.
Well, we'll see. I don't know what's going on down in Toronto. Maybe we'll have to keep tabs on that. But thank you for joining me this morning, and
Good to talk to you.
I look forward to speaking with you in the coming weeks.
Hasta luego.
Bye-bye.